Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Iran and impeachment are dominating the news headlines again. Iranian protesters took to the streets against their government after the Iranian military admitted it shot down a Ukrainian passenger plane last week. Different members of the Trump administration are offering differing explanations for the killing of General Soleimani. And after holding back the articles of impeachment for several weeks, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi will transmit them to the Senate this week. Plus, tomorrow, Democrats will take to the stage for the final presidential debate ahead of the first in the nation Iowa caucuses. So, yes, all in all, another big week in the news, and we will try to sort through it. This hour on Point, opening up our notebooks to the week ahead in Washington and beyond. And you can join us. What do you make of the Trump administration's reasoning for its actions on Iran and on impeachment? Has Speaker Pelosi held on to the articles of impeachment for too long? Or do you want her to take more time? Join us online, Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got a terrific panel with us today to help us understand the week ahead. And joining us from Arlington, Virginia is Amna Nawaz, senior national correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Amna, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And with us from Washington is Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor for Vox and co-host of the weekly international podcast Worldly. Jennifer, it's good to have you back as well.
Hey, Meghna. Great to be here.
And with us from Washington is Burgess Everett, congressional reporter for Politico. Burgess, great to have you.
Hey, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So first of all, let's start with the days of protests that we've been seeing in Iran against the government after the military admitted to shooting down that Ukrainian passenger plane. The Iranian military is saying it mistook it for hostile aircraft. Jennifer, what do you think the impact might be from these protests?
Well, I think it's a little bit too early to tell. I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen before in Iran is that when the regime has its back against the wall, it will at times allow a certain amount of protest to kind of as sort of like a steam valve to kind of let out the unrest and to kind of let the people have their say. But with the hope that it won't turn into something larger. But we're seeing a lot of anger about this. And it's interesting. It's different because it's not about, you know, the economic protests that we've seen before. It's very specifically about the downing of this jet. We've seen protesters saying, you know, I will kill those who killed my brothers, calling for the downfall of the regime. So it was definitely a huge misstep, obviously, in terms of the tragic loss of life. But in terms of the political calculations, you know, this was a huge accident. And I think even further, the way that the regime handled it by lying and saying that it was just, you know, human error, there was an accident, you know, and just stalling for so long. They even put out an alert to Iranian media saying, you know, do not go along with this Western propaganda saying that we did this, and then having to come out and say, oh, yeah, actually, we did this. Definitely not a good look. And it just kind of reiterates what a lot of Iranians have known for a long time, which is that their government is not honest with them and their government is, you know, not necessarily there with their best interests at heart.
Mm. Well, I'm always curious about whether or not we can see in protests like this. Again, let's take it from the Washington perspective, for example. That is it evidence of some kind of possibility or opening in terms of future diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Iran if there is enough discontent with amongst Iranians with their own government? Is that leverage somehow that can be used in terms of diplomacy between the two nations?
Well, I think you can see where the U.S. interests lie pretty clearly by some of the way the president and others have been weighing in a very limited way. But the president, President Trump, you know, messaging very openly to the Iranian regime that people are watching, the world is watching, you know, don't hurt your protesters, don't kill your own people. He's responding, of course, to the uptick in the crackdown that we saw from the regime on these protesters, even in this last round of protests that Jennifer was referencing, which were largely about economic means, right? It was about a lack of responsiveness from the government and providing jobs and meeting some of the economic demands of their population. All of that now has channeled into, as she said, this decrying of the mistrust, right? We couldn't trust you to handle our economy. We couldn't trust you to be honest with us about what's really going on here. And here you are lying to us again. There's always been a huge divide between the people of Iran and the regime of Iran. And for U.S. interests who want to wedge further into that divide, this is probably a good thing, right? Without being in the active and kinetic business of regime change, if the Iranian people are protesting and showing discontent with their own government, that's a good thing for the U.S. government. I think that really the thing to keep an eye on certainly today and in the days ahead is how the regime decides to respond. Because Jennifer's absolutely right. They will let a little bit of pressure off, let a little steam kind of blow off the top, but they have been cracking down more aggressively and more harshly in previous protests. They won't let this go on forever.
Mm. Burgess, you have a thought on that?
Well, I think the interesting parallel to watch is Congress is debating war with Iran, the War Powers Resolution, authorizations of military force. The Senate might take it up Tuesday or Wednesday, led by Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. The House voted to rein in the president's powers as far as it goes to Iran last week. So there's this sort of parallel unrest in Congress over the executive's power in declaring war and the strike on Soleimani. So, you know, we're seeing the president sort of take out some of his angst on some of his reliable allies who are complaining that they've been sort of sidelined in the constitutional debate about war and peace. So there's definitely some interesting stuff happening at the Capitol on this as well.
Yeah. And Jennifer, so reflect on what Burgess just said, because I was actually going to ask all of you about your thoughts on the War Powers Resolution. As he said, made it through the House. What's the next possible next steps there?
Well, yeah. I mean, if it heads to the Senate, if the Senate decides to take it up, I could definitely give it a lot more of oomph. You know, at this point, it's mostly just kind of a symbolic, statement that they're making. And, you know, Congress for a long time has made a lot of noise about wanting to rein in the executive branch. This is not the first time. It didn't even just start in the Trump administration. It's happened in previous administrations, with Congress really wanting to pull back some of its constitutional authority over war and peace declarations. The problem is that the executive branch does have the right and the ability to carry out certain strikes as long as they're within law otherwise, because of the need to have the executive, to have the commander-in-chief be able to act quickly, kinetically, to be able to respond to immediate threats, which is why they then have to go and, you know, and inform Congress of the actions and make sure that was followed through. But one of the things you're seeing in Congress is some people not wanting to actually tie the hands of the president, especially as things with Iran heat up. There's some hesitance even among some Democrats who really not wanting to have that look of, you know, we're really tying America's hands in defending itself should it need to.
Okay. Amna, did you want to just give us your thoughts on the War Powers Resolution? Because if not, I'm going to move ahead to what the president had been saying about intelligence and U.S. embassies. But I'm going to leave it up to you.
Yeah, I'll just briefly say I think it's important to remember that this is a 18-year-old resolution that every single president since then has used for various purposes to strike in various ways across a number of different countries. And it's not necessarily just that Congress wants to check the president's power. It's also that Congress has sort of actively abdicated their responsibility to involve themselves in those decisions. They really don't want to have to weigh in on every single strike in that way. So I think it's very unlikely this resolution is going to have any kind of impact.
Mm. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more then about sort of the shifting reasoning or the unclear reasoning, if I can put it that way, that we've been hearing over the weekend regarding President Trump's decision to authorize that strike that killed Iranian General Soleimani, because on Fox News on Friday, the president claimed that his motivation for the decision was that Soleimani had planned attacks on four U.S. embassies.
I can reveal that I believe it would have been four embassies, but Baghdad certainly would have been the lead. But I think it would have been four embassies, could have been military bases, could have been a lot of other things, too. But it was imminent. And then all of a sudden, he was gone.
All right. So then a couple of days later, in fact, just yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, anchor Margaret Brennan pressed Defense Secretary Mark Esper on the claim the president made that there was an imminent threat to four U.S. embassies.
The president didn't say there was a tangible, he didn't cite a specific piece of evidence. What he said is he believed.
Are you saying there wasn't one?
I didn't see one with regard to four embassies. What I'm saying is I share the president's view that probably my expectation was they were going to go after our embassies. The embassies are the most prominent display of American presence in a country.
That's the defense secretary, Mark Esper, on CBS yesterday. I'm not quite sure how to understand this moment, because the president often does this. He'll begin an idea with a specific claim, but then it sort of degenerates into, well, it could have been this, it could have been that, people say. So, I mean, is it plausible what Mark Esper is saying, that the president wasn't actually as specific as people first interpreted his statement to be?
I think the way to understand it is that there really wasn't any specific intelligence, that the president, who has long had a history of either making things up or exaggerating points, especially when he's talking to people at a rally or specifically messaging to his base, tends to be either broadly vague about certain points or specific without any evidence to back it up. And in this case, I think it is the latter. No one else in his administration, from his Secretary of Defense to the Secretary of State, certainly not the CIA director, based on the reporting we had from when the three of them went to go brief members of Congress days after that strike, has provided that same level of specificity. So I think that's where we are. Now, you can still argue that there's a basis for a strike, a justification for a strike, saying that there was an ongoing threat. You know, there's some argument to be made that Qasem Soleimani had a target on his back for years based on his activities in the region against U.S. troops themselves and also U.S. allies in the region. That is not what the president said. And so I think the messaging has provided sort of a further fog on top of the existing fog on the ground in terms of what was the actual justification and what does it mean for any future justifications, more importantly, right? If this is just something that the president can decide, as we've seen him decide by changing foreign policy via tweet, what does that mean for future U.S. engagement in the world?
Right. Well, Jennifer and Burgess, I'll get your take on this when we come back from a quick break. We're looking ahead at another big week in the news, and we want to hear from you. We're talking about the differing reasonings or justifications that are being offered by the Trump administration, by the Trump administration for the killing of General Soleimani. We'll take a look at the transmission of the articles of impeachment from the House to the Senate. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about another big week ahead in the news, everything from Iran to impeachment. I'm joined today by Amna Nawaz. She's senior national correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Jennifer Williams is also with us. She's senior foreign editor for Vox. And Burgess Everett joins us. He's congressional reporter for Politico. And Burgess, I just wanted to hear your take on sort of these shifting reasoning around or explanations around what intelligence the president did have on Iran's possible plans for four U.S. embassies. What's your take on that?
It just makes me think back to the beginning days of the Trump administration when the president alleged that President Obama tapped his phone lines, and this started this whole, like, ask every member of Congress, ask every member of the administration, is there any evidence for this? months, years later, you come to find out Trump says, oh, I was just referring to surveillance of my campaign. You know, I wasn't being literal. And so when he says this specific, very specific comment about these four embassies, I'm guessing this is going to probably play out in the same way that, you know, this was an intuition he had or something like that. And, you know, you all took it too literally and you shouldn't try to fact check these sort of statements. So this is something we've seen happen for 3 years now. And I see no, you know, the president is not going to change. He's going to keep doing this. What's different is sort of the magnitude of this particular situation with Iran.
Right. And Burgess, help me understand something, because it was just a couple of days ago that several members of Congress were voicing their discontent on the briefings that they got, the intelligence briefings they got after the fact. Right. And so, like, how do we know what they were told and how much that either does or doesn't overlap with the claims that the president's making?
So it's an interesting thing, right? You had these big all-senator briefing last week, and the Democrats came out and they were complaining that they were not really shown intelligence of, you know, an imminent strike, and they didn't really understand why we took out Soleimani. The more sort of, you know, interesting thing in terms of what happens in Congress was that two senators, Rand Paul and Mike Lee, came out and complained that the administration was telling them not to debate matters of war and peace publicly. And Mike Lee has been typically somebody who wants to restrain the executive power when it comes to the military, and he had been on the fence about whether to support this resolution on Iran, this war powers resolution, and he came out and he was so mad that he said, I'm supporting it now. So there's 47 Democrats, that's two Republicans, you get two more, Trump might have to veto this. The Congress has made him veto these sort of things before on Yemen, but nothing sort of at the magnitude of what's going on with Iran, because this has been obviously a signature issue of President Trump's. He hates the nuclear deal with Iran that President Obama clinched. So, you know, this could be kind of a pivotal moment. I sort of agree with the previous analysis that this is not necessarily going to be something that gets a veto-proof majority and actually substantively changes the executive's power. But anytime, I mean, you see how the president wants lockstep loyalty from Republicans, and anytime Republicans are willing to push back against him, it's an interesting story politically.
Well, Jennifer, I think we all are also trying to figure out how to understand decision making in the White House regarding these major, major issues. Because I was just seeing just this morning, NBC News had a piece saying, and I'm just reading at the top of NBC's piece here, saying President Donald Trump authorized the killing of Iranian Major General Soleimani 7 months ago if Iran's increased aggression resulted in the death of an American, according to five current and former senior administration officials. So what does that tell us?
Well, it definitely pokes a hole in the imminent attack argument. The way to think of it is, you know, the Defense Department and the National Security Council and all the people who work on this will essentially bring the president a menu of options and say, look, you know, we have this aggression from Iran. Here are some things we can do. And it'll range from, you know, very low level things like additional sanctions, not that sanctions aren't important, but lower level things too. It could a broader range all the way to very extreme options, including, you know, bombing Iranian oil facilities or, you know, bombing, you know, other Iranian military assets in the region. And then, you know, it looks like that the assassination of Qasem Soleimani was somewhere on that list. And he looked at that and said, yeah, that's something that I think we could do. I think it would be effective. But he did put conditions on it. He said, you know, I want to sign off on any final strike. I'm not authorizing this yet. I'm just saying that this is definitely something I would consider. And, you know, I think going back to Amna's fantastic point about the messaging here, I feel like the administration has really shot itself in the foot with the messaging. It shouldn't actually be that difficult to explain to the American people why Qasem Soleimani, who is responsible for the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans, of Iraqis, of Iranians, of Afghans in Syria, of Syrians, and all much, much more, why this person posed an ongoing threat. And the ongoing threat is something that is in the part of international law that is considered. It doesn't necessarily just have to be imminent. An ongoing attack, an ongoing armed attack. And I think that the administration could have feasibly made an argument that is convincing. But the messaging has been so across the board, just all over the place, that the administration hasn't really been able to make a solid case for a win here. And I think this goes back to something that analysts, myself and others, were worried about even when Trump was campaigning for president, which is the issue of credibility. You know, because he lies so often and because the administration has been so terrible at messaging and getting everybody on the same page, even for basic things like the gender of a dog that was involved in the Baghdadi raid, you know, if they can't get their messaging straight on something that simple, what happens when, you know, they actually need the American people to believe them for something that is a big military strike, yeah. Right? They could have very well have had the evidence and the intel for the strike, but they're not convincing the American people because they have this credibility problem.
So, Jennifer, if I may, though, let me just push back a little here for the sake of debate. Because,
sure.
I mean, I take your point that, you know, read one way, this shouldn't be a hard case to make. But read another way, the administration is trying to make the case of authorizing the assassination of a high-ranking member of the military of another country. That's what happened, right? And so there's the forever question about why now? And secondly, should the United States be going around assassinating members of the military in other countries? I mean, just think for a moment. Just for a moment. I just like to – this is a thought exercise here. How might Americans feel if a high-ranking member of the United States military that was involved in all sorts of activities in Iraq was assassinated? I mean, nevertheless, to the global community, that is the case that the United States has to make.
Right. Absolutely. And they have to make that broader case in several ways. One, you know, the case for, because it's not just an individual killing, right? That's why we're talking about this, yeah. Is the fear that this could escalate into a broader war. At this point, it seems, you know, God willing, that we're at a place where, you know, tensions on both sides are starting to kind of walk back from the brink. But that doesn't mean that the underlying tensions aren't there. And, you know, making the legal case, you can actually see some of the footprints of where the administration was heading when they designated a few months back that the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran, they designated them a terrorist organization. And you can kind of see that they were potentially laying the legal groundwork to say, look, this isn't a legitimate standing military. This is a terrorist organization. Now, that is a legal case that they would have to make that I am not prepared to lay out myself. But, you know, you could see where they were definitely heading that direction. And so, you know, being able to make that case, you would hope that they had laid out the legal justification first, especially if the NBC and there's Washington Post reporting backing this up, too. If those reports about 7 months ago are correct, that's plenty of time to work out a legal justification, which makes it a little bit even more disconcerting that, you know, even 7 months later and after an attack, and, you know, we're now several weeks, a week plus after the actual attack, that they're still not really managing to come up with any clear legal justification. But I will say one last thing, which is that, you know, in previous administrations, we did see, even in the Obama administration, the executive branch really, really working hard to not have to disclose their legal justification,
yeah,
for attacks.
Right.
So this isn't the first time that an administration has wanted to maybe keep that quiet.
Right. Good point. Well, I'm going to come to you in a second, but first of all, let's go to our callers. Let's go to Willem, who's calling from Colfax, Wisconsin. Willem, you're on the air.
Hello. I listen to a lot of foreign press, and I just think that the president of the United States lacks credibility. For some reason, the Republican Party is willing to accept a man who is a pathological liar. I mean, he at a rally last week, he talked about how there were 60,000 factories that were lost in the last administration, which is a total fiction, and about how the air is cleaner and the water is cleaner than it's been in 40 years. He makes these ridiculous statements. And how are we supposed to know as citizens when our president is telling the truth or when he's lying, when he's always lying? And why is this called his inaccuracies or their policies or not trying to get their ducks in a row? The man is a liar, and the whole world knows it. And so the question is, what do we do about it? I think he should be removed from office for incompetency because he's incapable of telling the truth. And this is what happened with Joseph McCarthy, the senator from Wisconsin. He almost brought down this nation with nothing other than total BS. And that's what this man is doing.
Well, Willem, let's get our panel a chance to respond. Thank you so much for your call. Now, what do you think?
I think what Willem is saying is something we've heard from a lot of people who, voters in America, right, who are concerned about what they can and can't believe. And also, broadly speaking, as he also mentioned, and Jennifer had referenced as well, what it means for our credibility in the world. You know, we're not just talking about political messaging, about the size of a crowd at a rally or inaugural speech, about poll numbers or something that can shift or is a bit abstract. We're talking about national security. We're talking about America's place in the world. We're talking about, in this specific instance, lives and deaths, because let's not forget there were 176 casualties as a direct result of this last escalation between the U.S. and Iran, despite the fact that the official messaging is there were no official casualties because no U.S. troops or Iraqi troops were killed in the strikes that were traded. But these things have real-world consequences. And I think, the best that we can do, certainly as journalists, and I hear both Burgess and Jennifer doing this extraordinarily well, is try to chase down the facts. What do we know to be true about what was said? And where can we point and say what the president is saying is a lie? That was not true.
Mm. Well, let's go to Ben, who's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Ben, you're on the air.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a lot of thoughts about the response from the Democratic candidates to this strike and how telling it has been. With one notable exception, pretty much every candidate has said that yes, Soleimani is the world's greatest terrorist and probably deserved to die, but this was the wrong way to go about doing this, which I think basically only serves to help Trump. At that point, you're trying to make this sort of legalistic argument, and it's the equivalent to, like, you know, an 80s cop movie where, Dirty Harry is, you know, willing to bend the rules to get the bad guys, and that's what you're making Trump look like with this. And I'll take my answer off the air on that.
Well, Ben, thank you. Thank you so much for that. Burgess, did you want to just respond to him?
I mean, I feel like the Democrats' message against the president has always been, you know, on foreign policy, that he's erratic and has made us an embarrassment around the world. The issue with Iran is, for the president, this is a big issue for him. Killing an Iranian terrorist leader, which is what most people in Congress would say Soleimani is not bad domestic politics for the president. And so it's not necessarily an issue that you're going to see the Democratic candidates sort of make the leading edge of their argument against why they should defeat Trump or impeach Trump. Even a question I was asking sort of offhandedly to senators last week was, you know, is this an impeachable offense if what he did in Ukraine is? And this is not something they wanted to touch with a 10-foot pole, because it's difficult to argue against the killing of Soleimani sort of on the merits of his history in Iran. And, you know, the other interesting thing is the previous caller, Willem, mentioned, you know, he wants the president removed from office. And it's funny, that's exactly what is happening in Washington this week, right? Is the impeachment trial is about to start. And because of what's going on in Iran, it's been obscured. I mean, I wrote a story last week. I think it's still, you know, prescient right now that I don't think the impeachment trial is the biggest story in politics right now.
Wow. So that's a beautiful segue, Burgess, because I want to ask you more about that.
Sorry, I keep stealing your segue.
No, honestly, it makes it easier for me. But we've had week after week of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying she is not ready to transmit those articles of impeachment to the Senate. And yet it's going to happen this week. Why?
First of all, the Congress went on a long holiday recess right after the House passed the impeachment articles. So there was really functionally no effect of her not sending that over for a couple weeks. The Senate was not going to take this up in December. Everybody wanted to go home. There was pretty much bipartisan agreement that this is going to start in January. So last week was the first one that started to have an effect, because as that week plotted forward, you started to see this sort of pile up happening. Oh, there's a debate on Tuesday. The Iowa caucuses are February 3rd. What is going to happen to these senators who are campaigning for president? How is this going to affect their campaigns? So you started to hear some of the frustration from Democratic senators and a few members of the House that they wanted Pelosi to send those articles over and the impeachment managers. And most of them walked it back after it became sort of clear to them, I think, internally that she was about to do it. And she's been arguing all along that she wants to see the sort of rules of the road from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, wants a fair trial, wants an avenue for more witnesses, more evidence. The Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer sort of taken up that campaign. You know, I would argue it's been a sort of a split result for Democrats. I think they have gotten a lot more attention to the issue of hearing from witnesses like Mick Mulvaney or John Bolton within the administration that were not heard on the House side, as well as documents. However, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell does not budge on this kind of stuff. You just need to look back at Merrick Garland's nomination to the Supreme Court to see that even when Democrats think it's bad politics, he's just not moving. So he basically used this time to lock up the votes to move forward with his own Clinton precedent, is what the Republicans call it, for President Trump's impeachment trial, which means opening arguments, make decision on witnesses and documents later.
Amna, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, the length of time between when the House vote wrapped up and when we knew the articles of impeachment would be transferred to the Senate allowed for a couple of things to happen. One was just world events took over, right? Who could have predicted back then that we could be on the brink of war with Iran and that we'd be, you know, talking about sending more U.S. troops abroad? It also allowed more time for the general public and also reporters to start to kind of pressure and ask and poke around and say, well, what would you do? What would you support this? You know, kind of putting a little bit more pressure, as we've seen happen with some members of Congress when they go back to their home constituencies and face questions in town halls and the like. But if you're Nancy Pelosi, and the goal was to try to get Republicans to agree to witnesses, then you failed. But if the goal was to try to keep impeachment in the headlines, and once the foreign news has died down, you come right back to it and put the focus on it, then she succeeded.
Well, we are talking about another big week in the news, and I'm joined today by Amna Nawaz, Jennifer Williams, and Burgess Everett. And yes, we're talking about the fact that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi intends to transmit those articles of impeachment to the Senate this week. Do you think it's about time, or do you want her to hold on to them a little bit longer? What do you think is going to happen next, and what's your question for our panel? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're taking a look at the week ahead in the news. And I'm joined today by Amna Nawaz. She's senior national correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Jennifer Williams is also with us. She's senior foreign editor for Vox. And Burgess Everett joins us as well. He's the congressional reporter for Politico. And let's just listen to a moment from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week yesterday. And here's the speaker discussing what she believes the differences are between the current impeachment process and the impeachment of President Clinton.
President Clinton allowed the witnesses to come forward. President Trump has prevented that from happening.
Why not wait for the courts to rule?
Well, because it'll be how long do the courts take? We have confidence in our case that it is impeachable, and this president is impeached for life.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday on ABC's This Week. Jennifer Williams, I just want to get your thoughts on the transmission of these articles of impeachment to the Senate.
Yeah, I think the fact that it, you know, the impeachment vote happened right before, you know, the holidays, before a lot of people went on vacation. You know, it wasn't just Congress who went on vacation. A lot of people did, right? And a lot of people stopped kind of tuning into the news. I know I certainly did on purpose. It was delightful. I highly recommend it. But, you know, and I think Amna's point earlier is spot on that, you know, if you are in Washington, right, if you are a reporter, if you are on top of this and you are, you know, immersed in this, then yes, it seems like a very long time has passed. But if you're just, you know, an average American going about your business, then, you know, the holidays were kind of a blur and you do that stuff. And now we're back to regular life. And, oh, OK, what's going on with impeachment? Is that still a thing? Oh, it is. OK, good. And they're going to keep going. So I think, you know, if Nancy Pelosi manages to, you know, get this to the Senate this week, then I think she's in the clear. I do think she was probably running up against the point of it starting to get to a little bit too long. You know, it could start to tilt into people going, okay, what's going on? Mm. You know, a lot of reporters have already been doing that. But I think the American people probably don't have one. First of all, don't have a timeline for what this is supposed to look like. Right. A lot of people, you know, lived through the Bill Clinton impeachment saga, but don't remember, you know, calendar wise. Well, it was 6 days from this, you know, so I think a lot of people are just expecting, OK, the holidays are over. This is going to come back and we'll move on.
Thank you for making that point, because there's no such thing as a normative impeachment process. It hasn't happened that often in U.S. history. Let's go to Jeremy, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that I think that she should, if there's a chance that if it's leverage, basically, to hang on to them until they make a decision on the witnesses, I don't understand how the Republicans can make a decision on the outcome already without hearing from witnesses. And, I mean, just as a general U.S. citizen that pays attention to the news, it looks like the Republicans have their head in the sand, and they're like, nope, nothing to see here, nothing to see here. And so we need to hear from people like Bolton, people that Trump has been blocking, in order to have this trial. And I don't understand how this can happen. If she should transmit it, if there's a chance that we can hear from witnesses and get this going, get it started.
Jeremy, can I just jump in here? I mean, you don't, I understand how you're feeling perplexed about this, but what you're describing, is exactly what has happened. I mean, the Senate Majority Leader has said he's going to run a trial exactly the way the president would want to.
And that, I don't see how that can be a trial, a fair trial, whether, you know, you had the during the impeachment part, you had the Republicans and the president saying that, look, it's not a fair trial because we can't have our witnesses. Well, then they turn around and say, well, you can't have your witnesses, but it's going to be a fair trial. It's the same thing with in the Clinton impeachment process. I mean, you've got a guy that committed something. It was a personal issue he had, and then just simply lied about it, and he got impeached. This guy is dangerous, and he is making decisions for the people who buy tickets to his rallies and his MAGA hats instead of the rest of the country.
Well,
I think that's dangerous.
Yeah, so Jeremy, let me get Burgess to help us out here, and thank you so much for your call. I mean, Burgess, maybe this isn't the right question, but I'm curious. I mean, in the context of an impeachment trial, Jeremy said the word fairness a couple of times. Like, what is fairness? What is a fair trial in an impeachment?
To be honest with you, it's whatever 51 senators agree to. I mean, the impeachment trial rules are sort of chaotic in the sense that anyone can offer a motion to do anything, and if you can get 51 senators to support it, a simple majority, no filibusters, just straight up, it can happen. And so Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, is going to offer these motions to hear from witnesses and hear new documents. And, you know, it's classic Schumer. He's this political strategist that is always sort of trying to figure out how to get an edge. And he's sort of presented this win-win situation in his view. You know, you either get enough Republicans to join your 47 Democrats to hear from some of the witnesses or get some of the documents that you want, or these folks vote against it and then they lose their reelection campaigns. Democrats are trying to take the Senate back, and a bunch of them, including people like Susan Collins, Cory Gardner, Martha McSally, Tom Tillis, you know, these folks are going to have some tough votes. And we're already seeing some movement from Senator Collins of Maine, a moderate who was here for the Bill Clinton impeachment trial. She's talking about, well, I do want to keep a pathway open for witnesses. So you can see sort of how, you know, this sort of chaotic process is starting to open up. And it's going to be really interesting how it plays out. But I think, you know, at its core, the Republicans have the majority. If Senator McConnell can win 51 votes, he can do whatever he wants to, and there's really no recourse other than the ballot box.
Okay, I want to play a moment from an interview yesterday on Fox News where House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy accused House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of holding up those articles of impeachment for a very specific type of political gain. Here's McCarthy.
The Iowa caucus is on February 3rd. Bernie Sanders is in first place. And what this does is this benefits Joe Biden. This harms Senator Sanders, who is in first place and could become their nominee, because he will be stuck in a chair because Nancy Pelosi held the papers different than what she said to the American public why she had to move so urgently.
That's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on Fox News yesterday. We've reached the point where maybe I shouldn't be surprised that the House Minority Leader cares at all about whether harm is done to Senator Bernie Sanders. But here we are. What do you think?
Yeah, the day, I don't think anyone had Kevin McCarthy sticking up for Bernie Sanders on their political bingo card this week. Look, a couple of things we know from that interview. One is that Kevin McCarthy can read the polls just as well as everyone else. He's absolutely right. Bernie Sanders is now leading in Iowa in the latest poll that came out just a few days ago. For the first time in the race, he is number one there. He's been consistently in the top. But also, you know, look ahead for a little bit. One thing to note is that President Trump's biggest attack on all the Democratic nominees is that they're all raging socialists, right? That the Democrats want to put a socialist into the presidency, and that is bad for the country. And that has been the message over and over again, regardless of who he's attacking. That's an attack most easily lobbed at Senator Bernie Sanders. And so you have to imagine that he wouldn't mind necessarily facing Senator Sanders in a general election. Right now, in the early states, in Iowa and New Hampshire, it's kind of a four-way tie among the potential Democratic nominees. There's former Vice President Biden, Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And so there's still a little bit of uncertainty there, but I think this was just Kevin McCarthy kind of leaning in, wanting to put his fingers on the scale a little bit to tip it towards someone that they can very easily attack when it comes to their political messaging.
Jennifer, sometimes I think, given your perch as sort of a wise owl of world news here, how do you see these moments where you think, oh, there's so much going on abroad, but look at the strangeness happening right here in our own backyard?
I basically just try to close my eyes and look away. Honestly, it's really the best strategy. I highly recommend it.
Okay. Well, let's go to Marianne, who's calling from Royal Oak, Michigan. Marianne, you're on the air.
Thank you. Nancy Pelosi is doing what her job is. All she wants is for the other side to lay out the rules, and it just rankles them. You can even see some movement with Mitch McConnell. She's right. Let's just set this up. She doesn't want our side to get in there and have them say, uh-oh, you should have done this or you should have done that, and they know it. Kevin McCarthy speaking up as he did is just outrageous. Mm. That's my comment. She's doing her job. Let her do it. We're a little bit ahead at this time. You can see some movement on the Republican side, and they just can't stand it. I hope she holds on to them until the last minute. I think she should get the rules and the managers in writing personally.
Marianne, thank you for your call. Burgess, you want to respond to her?
I just don't see a lot of leverage for the Democrats here. You know, you hold on to the impeachment articles. Let's just hypothetically say that she recants what she's said and she doesn't send them over this week. You know, what does that do functionally? Senator McConnell's just going to confirm more judges and pass Trump's trade deal. I mean, he doesn't want to have the impeachment trial. Like, this is not something that he's hoping happens. And if it does happen, he wants to get it over as soon as possible. And so I think shining a spotlight on what the Republicans are doing is definitely been achieved here. But as far as getting a result, I don't think so. On the 2020 front, I wanted to test this proposition. You know, me and my colleagues at Politico have been sort of debating whether holding senators in Washington in the modern era during an impeachment trial is good or bad for Sanders, Warren, Booker, Klobuchar, and Bennett, the five senators who are running. And so I grabbed Senator Warren, who was in the Senate last week for the Intel briefing, and I asked her, you know, does this matter? You know, how do you see this? And she said, don't tell me it doesn't matter. You know, she's kind of staking her bid on a lot of retail campaigning in Iowa, you know, hear a lot about her selfie lines and just the personal contact with folks. And these states, especially the first two early states, are small, and you can really get to know folks. And so she definitely pushed back against this idea that you can just keep campaigning on cable news and social media while you're stuck in Washington during the impeachment trial. So, yeah, Kevin McCarthy probably wants to face Bernie Sanders more than Joe Biden, but he is onto something in the fact that this is going to affect these senators' presidential campaigns.
I'm going to pick up on that. I mean, so it sounds like it does matter more than people want to let on.
I think it absolutely matters. I mean, I think the other thing to remember here is, you know, to Burgess's excellent point, these candidates are working different strategies, especially in these early states. Biden is relying heavily on familiarity and name recognition and his many, many years of experience. And honestly, this last week plus has been probably good for him, his camp would argue, when there's a focus on foreign policy. That is where he tends to lean in more heavily. And now that people are paying attention to this, in these last 3 weeks before those first crucial votes are cast in Iowa, that's something that's going to register a little bit more highly. But again, you know, Senator Warren is spending a lot of time on the ground. Pete Buttigieg is spending a lot of time on the ground. Being able to be there matters in this last stage. And we're already looking ahead to, of course, to Nevada and to South Carolina, where there's a lot more surprises when you look at the Democratic race. Tom Steyer surging into double digits last week. There's a great amount of uncertainty in the Democratic field. That's despite the fact we've had the same three or four candidates sort of vying for the top few positions in more recent polls over the last few weeks. And I think Democrats feel that, too. And so every single candidate is going to fight for every single advantage they have right up until the moment those votes are cast.
Well, let's listen to one of those Democratic candidates, what he is saying. Here is Senator Bernie Sanders on NBC's Today Show on Friday.
The way you beat Trump, and I believe this very strongly, is you're going to need a huge voter turnout. And that means you need a campaign of energy and excitement, which speaks to the working class of this country, which speaks to young people, which brings people into the political process who have never been in that process before. That is what our campaign is about.
Senator Bernie Sanders on NBC's Today Show on Friday. Let's go to Laura, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So here in the land of the first caucuses, I just was finding it interesting that the GOP seems to be on the defensive with these articles of impeachment. And maybe that is a recipe that we could use as Democrats to keep them on their toes and keep them from dogging us, because they really, you know, they're really scared of Sanders. They're really scared of Warren. And the way to keep them from being on the offense is to, you know, kind of keep them scared and running. And it seems to be working.
Laura, before I let you go, how's it feeling in Iowa right now? I mean, is there a lot of do you get a sense from, you know, you, your neighbors, your friends that are people sort of starting to fall into camps here?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, it's folks that have been doing this for a while, you know, either have their person that they're stuck with or they have a couple like I do. You know, I'm looking at Warren. I really like her. I like Cory Booker a lot. And Tom Steyer has best climate action plan. So it'll be really interesting the night of, because they have changed the process just a little bit. So there is going to be less chances to realign with somebody else. So it will be interesting. And folks are just like anywhere else in the country. We just have a little bit more of a front row seat. And as long as we don't get major snowfall the night of the caucuses, yeah, I think it'll be great.
There's always the weather to contend with. But Laura, thank you so much for your call. Amna, we have one more Democratic presidential debate coming up this week, right? And you were a moderator at the last one. I'm just curious, take us behind the scenes. What is it like being a moderator for one of these events?
It is incredibly stressful. It is incredibly intense. It's like cramming for the biggest exam you've ever taken. If you're anything like me, you overprepare and do not sleep and drink way too much coffee. So that's just my personal behind the scenes. These debates can be incredibly revelatory for a number of reasons, specifically for, we know, you know, the big chunk of voters who are still very much trying to make up their minds about who they're going to either, especially if the early voter is going to caucus for or vote for in primaries. And interestingly, in the last debate, we saw a lot of the firepower, if you will, kind of focused on a couple of candidates. One was certainly Mayor Buttigieg. We saw Senator Warren sort of open up lines of attack against him. Senator Klobuchar as well. And also there was a good amount of divide between, as you'd expect, between Biden and Sanders and Warren, largely on foreign policy and health care and the like, and sort of issues of governance and policy. So I expect those might continue, but I'm really going to be paying attention to those kinds of things tomorrow. Who among the Democrats, among the candidates, do they see as the biggest threats? And also foreign policy is probably going to take front stage in a way that it hasn't before.
And that debate's taking place in Iowa. So Amna Nawaz, senior national correspondent for PBS NewsHour, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor for Vox and co-host of the weekly international podcast Worldly. Jennifer, it's always great to have you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Burgess Everett, congressional reporter for Politico. Burgess, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thanks, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.